The ESRI, the new report from them, says that rent pressure zones have been successful in limiting rent inflation. Joining me now is Dr. Conor O'Toole. He is Associate Research Professor with the ESRI. Good afternoon, Conor.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for the time. So we hear this news that the rent pressure zones, which County Kildare is, the whole of the county is a rent pressure zone, have been successful in limiting rent inflation. But this report does note that it's not possible to completely separate the impact of broader economic conditions from rental price changes. And as we know, inflation is continuing to rise. Just go back over the main point there, that the rent pressure zones have been successful in limiting the rent inflation.
Sure. So the research that we did had two particular aspects. The first was a look internationally at how Ireland stacked up against other countries in terms of the design of the rules and, you know, were there lessons we could learn from other countries about what was happening or may happen here in Ireland. And then the second component of the research was to look specifically at the rental prices here in Ireland and to go through some detailed data at a contract level to see how much rent increases were happening for different properties across Ireland. And what we found was that if you compared areas which were in rent pressure zones, so there was a cap on the rent inflation rate, compared to other areas which didn't have these caps, that there was a degree of an impact on the price growth, the rental price growth. So that we can say that the rent pressure zones did have to some degree an effect on the inflation rates in these areas.
Now, to go back to what I said again, the report did also note, though, it's not possible to completely separate the impact of the broader economic conditions. We know the cost of living is continuing to rise steadily. And we've heard, you know, from international sources and obviously government officials here in this country that it's just going to continue to do so for at least the next year. So what does that mean in terms of the rent price changes?
Well, I think more generally, the rents are highly dependent on obviously the housing market context, the degree to which supply and demand are in or out of balance in the housing market, but also the broader economic conditions. And I think two things are important from a rent pressure zone perspective. Certainly, the work that we've done would suggest that if in the absence of those rules, for example, if they hadn't applied or if they weren't to apply now, the rental inflation that we would see would be greater than it is at present. And really that's due to the huge imbalance between demand and supply in the housing market. And that imbalance is unlikely to moderate in the near term, certainly as the economy recovers from the pandemic and the general price inflation in terms of the cost of living continues to rise over the coming months.
Conor, this may be a silly question to an extent, but obviously most of us partook in the recent census, obviously a legal requirement, but most people did partake in it. Could the official numbers that will come out in the next few months in terms of the population have any impact on potential increases in rent prices?
Well, I think what we see in general, regardless of what will be measured in the census, is we know from indicators we have now that there's huge pressure on the rental sector, and there's more people in the private rental sector now than there has been in the past. It's a tenure that's increased in importance over the past number of years. So I think that based on any estimates that are out there, the number of new households forming indicates continued upward pressure in terms of the demand side of the housing market. So it's likely that in terms of rental prices or indeed house prices, it is likely to have considerable inflation built into the system as the economy recovers, certainly in the near term.
Now, as an author of the report, you did note that the expected recovery in the Irish economy, rent controls are probably going to be needed again into the future. In quote, they should be considered an essential part of the rental market policy tools. If we look at this county, if we're already currently the whole of the county a rent pressure zone, what potential, added controls could be put in place? Or would this be looking wider in terms of the country and more areas of the country becoming RPZs?
I think that's more a more general point, and it's to do with the context of, you know, the, initially when the rent pressure zones were introduced, it was for a specific time bound period, you know, for up to 3 years. And in a sense, the expectation was that if the inflation rate moderated, maybe that type of instrument wasn't needed in the future. And our kind of assessment now is that given the underlying fundamentals in the housing market, it's likely that these imbalances between supply and demand will continue for the foreseeable future. And therefore, you know, having an instrument like rent pressure zones or an inflationary cap, which can help to really top out that high inflation rate, does make sense. There are certainly economic rationales for having that. And that was one of the areas that we covered in the research.
We've heard from lots of people who are renting properties, noting the state of the property not being of high quality at times. And to go back on international evidence that's been noted again in the report, many landlords, when they're faced with these strict price controls, don't tend to invest in properties as much as previously. So if you're in a rent pressure zone, going by that, you know, statement or fact, then can you potentially expect your rental property not to be as of high standards compared to somebody outside an RPZ?
I don't think it's as clear cut as that. I think the best way to think about it is with these measures that help cap the inflation rate, the obvious beneficiary of that is the sitting tenant. But what's found internationally is that often these type of rules come with side effects or health warnings, that if they're too strict or if they're overly, you know, capping of the rent increases or the rent level, that landlords can often over time not invest in the properties or in an extreme case, withdraw the property from the market or reduce the overall supply level. So it's not necessarily that we see that in Ireland at present, but the health warning is there that this may happen in certain circumstances. So, you know, within the Irish framework, there are allowances. So if landlords make major investments in the property, and or if they do energy efficiency upgrades, for example, they are allowed to reprice the rent, and that's very appropriate. And hopefully that mechanism may mitigate some of these issues around the deterioration in the investment and maintenance over time.
Balance is something we're all looking for in all aspects of life. You have said that it's a tight balance between protecting tenants from excess inflation while also allowing traditional investment. Explain to us what you mean by that.
Yeah, so as I was mentioning there, it's kind of a trade-off. With these policies, there's always trade-offs. So naturally, when you bring in a rent control like this and you're dampening the price growth, then the beneficiary there is the existing tenant who faces a lower increase in the cost of their rent over time. So that's the beneficiary. But the impact of that may be that over time, the landlords exit the market or that they may not invest as sufficiently as they otherwise would have in the property. And that's not necessarily always going to be the case, but that is the risk that carries with these type of instruments. And in a sense, it's that trade-off and balancing that trade-off that policymakers have to be cognizant of when they're setting these rules over time.
This is something that I'm sure you completely understand, but a lot of people will be asking, make it make sense. Why does it cost so much more to rent than to pay a mortgage of a property? And this property that you may be renting, might even be a bigger size or located in a more in-demand area in terms of pricing compared to the rental property. Yes, you'd still be forking out way more to rent a property in this country.
Well, I think that's certainly outside the scope of the research that we did. But in general, you know, there are various different reasons why factors that drive home ownership prices, so the purchase prices in the housing market versus the rental prices. In a sense, access to be able to get into the home ownership market through access to credit, through rules on credit access, will all impact the degree to which households choose their tenures or are able to choose their tenures, and that can funnel a demand from the rental sector to the homeownership.
Yeah, so in regards to that, Connor, the demand is there for people to own homes, but obviously they can't set out the steps that they possibly need in terms of, you know, applying for a mortgage, etc., because they do not have the finances behind them, meaning that the demand for owning a house may be there, but it's not possible.
Certainly, that may be the case. There is, certainly previous research we've done would have shown quite a preference for home ownership among households. So that's certainly clear in the Irish case, I think.
Okay, well, it's very interesting. I'm sure a question that will keep coming up. A lot of people out there trying to get on the housing ladder. And just to go back over some of the findings from the report that Connor did author, 48 to 50% of tenancies in zones introduced in 2016 and 2017. And those introduced in 2019, as I said, County Kildare, the whole area is a rent pressured zone, had increases in rents that were above the average 4% cap. That is the author of that report, Associate Research Professor at the ESRI, Dr. Connor O'Toole. Now, some of you, if you were reading the Irish Independent today, you will have seen this headline, dozens of families suing the HSE after a loved one did contract COVID-19 and died in hospital or in private run nursing homes across the country. And joining me to discuss this is a partner at H.J. Ward, litigation solicitor and former president of the Law Society of Ireland. That is Stuart Gilhooly. Hi, Stuart.
Hi, how are you?
I am good, thank you very much. I was speaking with you earlier, organising this interview, and I noted having conversations with people I knew of that had a loved one or, knew of somebody going into hospital over the past, 2 years, maybe even kind of at the beginning of the pandemic when we didn't have the vaccinations, and that loved one did contract COVID-19. And I noted, not that I know anything, but I did note at the time, just because we're known as a country that have a lot of legal issues and our legal system has to be sorted out to many degrees, that could there be a possibility of suing in the future? And it seems as if that has come to fruition now.
Yeah, I suppose it has, Kira. I mean, it's one of those ones where at the start of it, I think there was a lot of speculation that there'd be a huge number of COVID cases, particularly in workplaces, and I suppose hospitals were always going to be a possibility as well. And I don't think that's come to fruition in the sense I don't think we've seen many people take cases for COVID, because I think in most cases people get COVID, they recover from COVID, and while some people have had a fairly severe reaction and others indeed have had long COVID, thankfully most people have recovered from it. So they tended not to pursue it. And also I think, it can be very hard to prove where you got it.
Flagged that was one of the first things in the conversation, and it must be extremely difficult for any solicitor to look at a case like this and try and pinpoint the exact moment or try and give evidence as to why their claimant is claiming that they contracted COVID in this certain place.
Yeah, it's very difficult. I mean, I think it probably would have been easier back then at the very start when the country was in lockdown and most people weren't going to their workplaces and they weren't going into pubs or anything like that. So there was, you certainly could narrow it down. But equally, how do you know you didn't get it home? How do you know you didn't get it from, a relation or somebody that you even met in a shop? So it's very, very difficult to say, look, definitively you got it in a certain place. But I suppose you don't have to prove it definitively. All you have to do is prove it on the balance of probabilities, which is a 51% chance. So if you can show, in the situation like a hospital where somebody perhaps had been staying for the maybe 5-10 days or longer, or even for a shorter period, you're probably able to show that there actually probably is very few other places they could have got it from.
And that 51% chance, again, it goes back to the chances of one being able to prove that to that 51% of a degree. Because now that COVID-19 is circulating much more easily in society, I'm sure people taking cases around this sort of time will find it much more difficult to prove these things compared to 2020 and 2021, where we did spend huge amount of times in a full lockdown.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, how many times have you had a conversation with somebody recently where they've told you they got COVID and you've asked them where they got it from and they say, I haven't a clue. And, most of us just don't know where we get it these days. But it is very different now to how it was back then. And as I said, I think if somebody was in hospital for any sort of period of time and they could show that they went in perfectly healthily and then suddenly that person was found to have COVID maybe, say, 4 or 5 days later. I mean, in reality, the only place they could have got it at that stage was in the hospital or in a nursing home. I think nursing homes are one of those places where you could prove pretty much exactly where you got it from, because most residents of nursing homes don't leave the nursing homes. So I think that's those sort of cases are the sort of ones you are now seeing, and particularly where people have died. I mean, obviously, the person who's died clearly can't sue, but their family can. and there are cases that can be taken for damages. Now, damages for the death of a loved one are incredibly low in this country. You cannot get more than €35,000 for the death of a loved one. And that must be shared by all of what we call the dependents, which are effectively all the relations. So if, for instance, an elderly person dies, they may have brothers and sisters who would qualify for some of that $35,000. You've got children, usually spouses, and possibly grandchildren. So you're dealing with quite a lot of people who are expected to effectively share a very small amount of money for something that's extremely traumatic for any family.
You know, showing compassion, the saddest part of these situations is majority of people who did go into hospital not with the virus and contracted it there were going in because they needed to be there. They were unwell in some way and unfortunately they would have contracted the virus. Some people obviously horrifically sad dying from the virus and some people having things like long COVID and their lifestyle being impacted going forward. The state claims agencies, they manage personal injury and property damage claims taken against the state and state agencies, and they said that these claims relate to deaths that occurred in private nursing homes, community health units and hospitals during the pandemic. So if you look at the HSE in terms of the hospital, one can understand that. You mentioned about the private nursing homes there in particular. They really went on full lockdown compared to the hospitals. People obviously had to come in for reasons, emergency. I know some people were on COVID wards when they did not have COVID, when, you know, overcrowding, that's an issue with our hospitals for years and years and decades and decades. But when it comes to the private nursing homes, it was a full lockdown, you know, visitors weren't there. Do they have more of a case, in quotes, because, you know, you're taking a motion out of it there, which you do need to do in terms of the legal system. Yeah. But I can completely understand people listening are going to be saying you can't speak about things like that in this way. But would you assume as a solicitor in litigation that one has more of a case against a private nursing home?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't even necessarily think it's even the private nursing homes, but I think any nursing home or any place where you have somebody who has been in situ for any sort of period of time. Going back to my point, I suppose, about whether somebody's been there for more than 5 days. If, for instance, you have been in any residential health facility for a period of, say, 5 days or more, and you then contract COVID, I think the answer has to be the only place you could have got it was in that place. So then you're at the second part of the legal issue, which is what fault does the nursing home or the hospital have in this regard? And it's not a strict liability situation. You know, by that I mean you're not guaranteed to win just because somebody got COVID in that place doesn't mean that it's the fault of the place that had it. You have to prove that they were negligent in some way. You have to prove that they could have somehow stopped this occurring. So what you're then looking at is their systems. You're looking at, you know, to what extent were they controlling people coming in and out? To what extent were they testing employees? To what extent were they practicing social distancing? To what extent were they putting all the other, the washing hands rules, all the sort of rules that we're all so painfully familiar with now, to what extent were they carrying all of these out? If you could show that they had carried out all of those systems and done them properly and it still happened, you know, then you're not going to succeed in the case because the fault, as I said, is not a strict liability one. It is simply a case of showing that they could have stopped this somehow. So, yes, if you could show that they didn't have proper systems, that they did overcrowd, that they did they were letting employees in without properly testing them, yeah, I think that's definitely a very good case against any of those institutions. But again, if they were to do all their work properly, then maybe it's not guaranteed to win.
Look, this is an area that the legal system hasn't dealt with before. If you're talking about precedents, would you want to be the solicitor that is trying, you know, the second case rather than the first, or would you want to be the solicitor managing the first case?
I don't think necessarily. I think each case turns on its facts. I think that's important to establish because it comes back to, you know, the place where it was, what the systems were in that place, what the individual possibilities of the person having contracted it somewhere elsewhere. So I don't think it necessarily matters. I mean, I don't think a precedent is necessarily going to help you in that the likelihood is the facts of each case are going to be different. So I don't think it necessarily matters. But I certainly do think that if somebody has died in a residential health facility in the early stages of COVID, I would think that in general their chances of success are more likely than not.
Now, if we just go into what the state claims agency is saying, there are 33 cases or claims relating to private nursing homes and one claim that relates to the death of a healthcare worker. But also, Stuart, the HSE is facing 14 legal claims. That's arising from people being infected with the virus allegedly acquired in the workplace. Would you assume in this case, I know you don't know, but would you assume it if somebody's coming forward with contracting the virus in a workplace, would it be something, as in, when I say would it be, would they have gotten the legal advice to go forward with this because it's in a situation of an overcrowded workplace or, you know, places like the meat plant factories that we heard of over the past 2 years?
Yeah, you would think it would be something like that. You would think that it's one where they haven't exercised proper health controls, where they haven't put in the systems that were, that, you know, that everyone was told to put in before you opened your workplace. For following the first lockdown, I think everyone knew what the HSE procedures were, and that they set out what workplaces were expected to do. But I'm going to give you an example now of a case, and I'm not going to name the place because it wouldn't be appropriate. But it's actually a case that I have recently taken on, and interestingly, it was one where again at the very early stages, a person working in a healthcare facility is bringing a case because she brought in her own mask and was told that she was not to wear the mask because she would scare the patients.
Yeah, it really is a case by case, because I was going to ask you there about the system. Mm-hmm. Can we potentially see, and that's me asking you to look into a crystal ball, but can you potentially seeing things change in terms of cases being brought forward? Because people out there will hear this and they'll go, well, maybe I have a case.
Well, I think in order to have a case, you have to establish a couple of things. Number one, you have to show that you got it in that particular place. You have to be able to prove that on a balanced probabilities basis. That's number one. Number two, you have to show that there was fault on the part of the workplace or the place where you are alleging was, you call it, say, for instance, a hospital. So that's, again, you have to show they didn't follow proper controls. And the third thing you're going to have to do, I think, even though technically any claim for COVID is a claim for damages because there is an injury involved, I think for you to succeed, you're going to have to show you the serious COVID injury. You're going to have to show that you had, say, long COVID or that you had something that hospitalized you for at least weeks and affected you for several months afterwards, or, God forbid, somebody who died. So I think that's the sort of cases you'll see. I don't think you're going to see many for, you know, the sort of sniffles and flu symptoms that most people did have during the course of it. I think you're looking at the more serious ones. And we do know, of course, that there are quite a few cases of long COVID out there. And I think that's the sort of case that maybe you will see. But again, you have to prove where you got it, and you have to prove that the person who gave it to you could have prevented it.
Briefly, Stuart, just looking at other civil law countries, have similar cases been brought forward or claims been brought forward as of yet?
I'm not aware of any. I haven't been following that aspect of things. I don't know about other common law countries. I mean, like, every jurisdiction is different. You know, you don't know what rules they put in place. You don't know what their laws are. You don't know what their what the health advice were. I mean, if you take, for instance, the UK, the health advice over there was quite different at a lot of stages to what it was here. So I think a lot of it will turn on the advice that you've got and the health and safety regulations you have, and then obviously it'll come down to the sort of damages that you might expect to receive in those sort of countries as well. So I think it varies very much from country to country, and I think we're struggling, even in this country, to understand what effect this is going to have in the absence of any of these cases that actually haven't come to court yet.
Well, really informative. Thank you so much for joining me this afternoon. That is Stuart Gilhooly. He's a partner at H.J. Ward. He's a litigation solicitor and he's the former president of the Law Society of Ireland. And just to reiterate it, the State Claims Agency, they manage the personal injury and property damage claims taken against the state and state agencies. These claims relate to deaths that occurred in private nursing homes, community health units and hospitals during the pandemic. In a breakdown of the 39 claims, 33 relate to private nursing homes, one claim relates to the death of a healthcare worker. And then separately, the HSE is also facing 14 legal claims arising from COVID-19 infection allegedly acquired in the workplace. Thank you so much, Stuart. The Dawn Walk Kildare event is taking place on the 23rd of April this month. It's at 5 a.m. from Kildare Village. And joining me to let us know what exactly it is the manager of Chocdara Community and Family Centre. That is Sarah Shakespeare. Hi, Sarah.
Hiya, Ciara. Lovely to be on.
Well, it's lovely to speak with you again. Before we get into the Dawn Walk itself, let us know what Chalk Dara does over in Kildare Town.
Chalk Dara is a community and family centre. We are a family resource centre and we're based sort of slap bang in the middle of the town. We run everything from food bank to family support to different groups within the centre, and then our counselling service. We have 6 counsellors based upstairs in the centre, so it means you could walk in for one thing and you could probably find out that you need 3 other things, but it's a lovely welcoming centre that means that because you could be walking in for parent and toddler or for the grandparent group, then you could be also going up to access that counselling, but without sort of people knowing what you're going in for, which is why I love the place.
It's pretty amazing, because the Dawn Walk Kildare is a fundraiser. We'll get into that in a moment, but it does allow Chalk Dara to offer free crisis counselling sessions in the centre itself, which is so crucial for so many. And as we know, with the cost of living, is so out of reach for so many to actually pay for that.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that, and I mean, you've got, well, even your two previous guest speakers, you have sort of the cost of living and housing and how everything is going out there. And then you have this whole COVID situation. And I think that both of those things, that cost of living and COVID, have put an extreme piece of additional pressure onto every family and onto every person. So, and then it's like, I really do need help. I am struggling. I can't pull €50 for that when I know my ESB bill's gone up by another 50 this month or whatever, you know?
Also, the cost of centres like yourselves and charities to stay afloat over the past 2 years has been difficult. If we look at Chalk Dara, how have ye fared over the 2 years?
I think what we have done, it now we stayed going, and I think that has stood to us. I think we've gained a lot of credibility with, let's say, local businesses, and probably with some of the more established families even in the town, that they've actually realised that, Jesus, they're still doing it. You know, we were running food bank 2 days a week. You know, we maintained that. We had our family support piece. It meant that I was operating out of the car more often than not and calling to houses during that time, and our services for the counselling piece, at some stages they went on to phone calls, they went to in person as soon as we could, and even with lockdowns we were an essential service, so we kept that. And I mean, the bottom line with Dawn Walk is that we can continue to say yes to people, but only if we generate the monies to do that.
Now,
you know,
before we touch on Dawn Walk, just to let people know, this is quite incredible. So these are free crisis counselling sessions you can get at Chalk Dara. In March of this year, Chalk Dara covered 73 sessions to support people who needed counselling. Obviously, some of those who are in the most dire need of that support. And the Dawn Walk Kildare event on the 23rd of this month is going to help people so much. Do let us know why exactly you do the walk each year.
Well, why we do the walk is that really when I was thinking about coming on, and I sort of went, no, I am, and Ciara Plunkett would be the prior example of saying, Sarah goes off on a tangent because she gets all passionate about what she does. So I wrote myself notes this time to stick to the point, Sarah.
We like passion. We like passion, Sarah.
But I think I'm very passionate about what we do. But what I did look at was, okay, why are we doing this walk? And in March, those 73 sessions that we offered, now some of them were the weekly basis, so there may be people that may have been in 3 times in that month or may have been finishing up. But basically in March we had, and this is just a quick snapshot because this puts it in perspective, we had one crisis call from a school principal for an 11-year-old girl that we were immediately able to give counselling to. I had one gentleman on with an addiction issue. I had a Ukrainian lady, very good English, but is in danger of being the only person who can speak English for people, and she needs to access counselling. So we have that sorted for her. I have one case of self-harm, 3 14-year-olds, two lads and a girl, 3 crisis school referrals, so they're from the primary school here in Kildare Town. I've had social work and InSync, which is the youth service. Big thing is the youth service have a very under-resourced actual counselling service, but it's a 6 month wait. Now, if you've got a 15-year-old who's brave enough to say, I'm really in trouble.
If you have anybody brave enough to say that, a wait is a wait at the end of the day, isn't it?
Yeah. And I mean, I've one 12-year-old girl. I've one 16-year-old girl. I have four mothers of those children, because what is also happening is you've got somebody who rings up and goes, I'm really worried about my son. We had a lovely lady whose son attempted suicide recently, and she said, I'm up the walls worried about him. And what's happened is, as he started to actually engage in the service and actually sort of discuss stuff more, she's actually come and gone, Sarah, I'm really in trouble. So we are now supporting her as well. So there is a family piece there, and we're a family centre. So it means then we can hopefully then be in a position to link some of these people out the other side of the crisis and into our family support service. We have a lovely family support worker here in the centre, Fiona, who's new to us here and is fabulous. So it's going to be a really positive time as well. But the bottom line is, if I haven't got the money, I'm going to have to start saying no when people ring and are brave enough to make that call. Everyone who's rung, I've said, okay, leave me a day, and within 24, 48 hours, we're able to get them hooked up.
Sarah, it's so crucial then for people to donate, especially when it's services within their local community. And we know a lot of people, majority of people listening to the station right now, will be living in the county. If they do want to partake in the walk, or if they do want to donate, give us those two details, please.
Yes. Basically, there is eventmaster.ie. If you go onto Eventmaster and you search, you just type in Dawn Walk, that will bring you to a link. You can register for the walk. It's €20 for adults and €10 for children. It's actually a fabulous walk. Starts at Kildare Village, and it actually goes the whole way around past Bridget's Well, back in, and it finishes at the Silk and Thomas. They're a brilliant supporter of us, and we have a number of local businesses that support us, but that means everyone gets a breakfast and a tea and coffee. You know, it's a really nice end
at that time of the morning, a breakfast.
Yeah, we've met a couple of revelers on the way home from something the night before, and it's always been great crack, but it's really a lovely event, because you're starting in the dark, you're finishing in bright, and you've got that nice feeling when people finish. So it's eventmaster.ie, and people can also, if they don't want to register online, they can also come into the centre or make contact with the centre. And we also have some posters up around Kildare, and I have them on the Facebook page, which have those. I got all tech savvy. I did. I was a bit impressed with myself, but I actually created those QR codes
so
people can beat their phone, and if they want to donate a 5, a 10 or €20, if they're out locally and they think, I can't do that walk, but I'd like to give a couple of quid. My take on it is €50 is an hour of counselling for anyone who needs it, and that's two adults and a child doing that walk, having a nice time, that they also have a mindful time that they can think about somebody that they possibly lost to suicide, or somebody who's struggling with their mental health, and that it's an opportunity that they can then come into us.
Yeah, it's a really lovely thing. It's amazing. I'm sure you get told this all the time, and you're probably like, oh, stop. What you're doing is amazing over at Chock Dara. It's the Community and Family Centre in Kildare Town. As I noted, 73 sessions in March alone were covered to support people who needed vital counselling. And this fundraiser, the Dawn Walk Kildare event, it's taking place on the 23rd of April. Eventmaster.ie is where you can go and sign up. It's at 5 a.m. from Kildare Village. I actually did it in 2019, and it was so lovely. It's such a nice...
Even a storm. Do you remember that?
It was
brilliant.
But you know what? That was a bit more exciting, wasn't it?
We don't want red weather warnings. I'd like it. But also, I mean, I know some people are on saying, look, can we just donate? I'm going to be honest, I'll take anybody's money. I'm not proud on that point. My deal is the more money that we get, the more people we can help. But the other side of it is, it is a lovely event.
And real feel good,
And they want to make a thing of it, you know, be something cool to do.
And if people have been directly affected by suicide, I believe that they will find some solace just in that, you know, group, and in that feeling that, you know, there's people around you and you're physically seeing that there's people there to support.
We did a lovely lady after the 19 walk who sent me a message and said, I was really struggling, and somebody just checked in with me and said, you okay? And I thought, deadly. You know, that's what we're doing. That's why it's important.
Well, it's so important what you do. Thank you so much for joining me. You are, of course, Sarah Shakespeare, the manager of Chalk Darrow Community and Family Centre. Thank you for the time this afternoon. And as we're mentioning, the Dawn Walk Kildare event is taking place on the 23rd of this month, begins at 5 a.m. from Kildare Village, finishing up around the Silken Thomas, and people can get their cup of coffee, their breakfast roll, whatever it may be. As Sarah was noting, eventmaster.ie. More information will be up on KFM Radio's website, kfmradio.com. Now, coincidentally, my next topic does link in with suicide. So there's new research. It's on the link between adult ADHD and suicide. It was revealed at the spring conference of the Irish College of Psychiatry. We heard from Sarah there how important it is for people to get support who need it, vital for so many out there. And I'm sure Ken will only back that up. Ken Kilbride, who's the chief executive of ADHD Ireland. But Ken, we're going to focus specifically on this new research. So you are the chief executive of ADHD Ireland. This is what ADHD want to expressly say, informing parents of children with ADHD that it's important to recognise that 90% of the respondents to the survey were first diagnosed as adults. So that's very important for parents listening out there who may hear that that headline and maybe be quite worried by it, Ken.
Oh, indeed, that's absolutely what we wanted to put there. But just before we get into that, just obviously I'd like to, you know, say congratulations to Sarah and anybody in Chalk Darrow. That sounds like a great event coming up on the 23rd, possibly even on the car and drop down for that myself.
Well, we'd love to have, that would be lovely, Ken. Yeah, no, it's a great initiative. And as I said, more information will be up on KFM Radio's website. And I don't mean to dismiss that because it's incredibly important, but so too is this research. And we only have a limited amount of time, Ken. Yeah. So this research, introduced or revealed at the spring conference of the Irish College of Psychiatry. So the headlines from the result: 20% of all adults with ADHD have attempted suicide in their lifetime. That's 20%. 50% of all adults with ADHD have self-harmed in the past, and 10% consider suicide an option for the future. Really, 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 really incredibly sad to read those three key pieces of information they found from this survey. We had you on just a couple of months ago, Ken, in regards to ADHD. This research, I'm sure, has really hit the association hard.
Oh, it has, you know. Now, we did do sort of some desk research before we did our own research and had to look at some international studies. And, you know, we're not too far off them, so we're pretty much sure of these figures. And again, you know, we were expecting to be bad, but honestly, we were horrified when we got the results back. And again, we did this survey with the Office for Clinical Services for ADHD in the HSE, and we did it with the School of Psychology, Professor Jessica Raman in UCD. And so, and again, we've all been shocked by these results. And, you know, it just goes to show that, you know, when you don't get the ADHD managed and treated, it does cause difficulties across the entire lifespan for a person.
Now, it is noted ADHD people, adults, I should say, with ADHD, have elevated levels of suicidal behaviours. I'm sure this is a very vague question to ask, but is there any answer to why that is?
There's a couple of answers to that. Someone would say one of the things, you know, that within ADHD, there can be an awful lot of what's called coexisting conditions around depression, anxiety, substance misuse, around alcohol. And then when you throw that in with, you know, one of the key behaviours of ADHD, which is impulsivity. And, you know, there is other research that shows this, you know, that because of that impulsivity, when someone thinks about suicide, they might think that that's not a great idea. But because of that impulsivity with ADHD, you just go and do it. So that could be one of the reasons why people with ADHD would have higher rates there as well. And then again, just because of the stigma that goes with the condition and the low self-esteem that comes with it. So they're the type of things that can affect them, particularly as they go into adulthood. And as you say, when it's not being managed and treated as they go into adulthood and across their lives.
Now, sticking on the results of the research and the figures, there's three key initiatives that have been highlighted, recommended as imperative. One of those is CARE in this country, increased capacity in the adult ADHD specialist services as part of the national clinical model of care, training for primary care, secondary care and tertiary level staff, including in emergency departments and the voluntary sector of ADHD Ireland, the interventions for those who are not receiving formal services. Many people can't afford to get formally assessed when they are adults, I'm sure, Ken. In general, care in this country in terms of ADHD, is it quite low?
It is. Now, again, there is a plan from the HSE in terms of the budget. So, again, Kildare Regions was in CHO7. So there is a plan to have a separate or a specialised ADHD clinic for adults opening and running in the Kildare area by the end of the year. But that's subject to recruitment of psychiatrists. And within that plan, it's hoped that, you know, nationwide, that we would have sufficient clinics around the country within the HSE, that would be what we call 50% coverage for the entire population. And then maybe over the next 2 years after that, have sufficient that there would be 100% coverage for everybody. But at the moment, yeah, it's difficult to get services. It's difficult to get services through the HSE. And currently, you know, we would have a list on our website, adhdireland.ie, of clinicians that are doing assessment for adults. But one thing.
So is that the advice you'd give to anybody listening right now and they're an adult and they want to get assessed? You would advise them to go onto the ADHD Ireland website before they do anything else in terms of, you know, doctors, GPs, whatever it may be?
Yeah, just to get the information. But what we would say is, you know, that there's two routes. One is through the HSE. So certainly go to your GP for that and see if you can get the referral. And if you don't...
Now, let me just ask you about that, Ken, to see if you could get the referral. Have you any idea as to what exactly one needs to note or highlight in their lives that would help in terms of a referral?
Well, again, if you run a support line, and, you know, this is just a very typical call that, you know, I personally took myself this morning.
Okay.
You know, there was a lady, she was 40, and she was saying, look, I've had, you know, difficulty with anxiety, depression, substance misuse over the years. I always knew it was something else. How do I go to get an ADHD diagnosis? And, you know, when I've said before, you know, if we got a euro for everybody that came to us and said, you know, I'm in my mid-40s, you know, I have anxiety and depression, probably substance misuse, all the difficulties like we're expressing here, and was looking to get, I think it was undiagnosed ADHD, we wouldn't need funding from the HSE. There is, forgive me for using the word pandemic of it, but there's 150,000 adults out there who probably would meet the clinical criteria for an ADHD diagnosis and who haven't got diagnosed as children. And now we're now coming to realisation that there's something in their lives that's different, something that's driving them differently, and they're wondering what it is. And again, I've been saying, you know, since the start of the year, and probably 3 months into it, from September last year, we have just been overwhelmed with calls. And particularly from adults looking to get information on how to get a diagnosis. But as I say, you know, there is the challenge of getting it through the public sector. And at the moment, as I say, you know, it's nearly impossible to get through the private sector in Ireland. So you do face a situation, you know, where it's always better to get the assessment and get the treatment. But getting it in Ireland today is nearly impossible. Or it's a challenge, let's put it that way.
That's very unfortunate to hear that, but I don't think people are surprised, Ken. Listen, thank you so much for joining me. There will be more information on kfmradio.com. Caoimhe is going to put that information up a little bit later. So if anybody is looking for more, as Ken was saying, the ADHD Ireland have a helpline, and I have the number here. The helpline is, unfortunately, I don't have the number here in front of me. I will get that number. Ken, do you have it there?
Of course, yeah. 01-874-8349.
Oh, I do have that. I was worried that was your private number. That's why I was giving that one out. Perfect, perfect. Okay, so 01, a Dublin number, 874-8349 is the helpline for ADHD Ireland if anybody out there is looking for more information. Thank you so much, Chief Executive of ADHD Ireland, Ken Kilbride.